From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Early voting ends this Friday in Georgia, and the governor's race between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp and charges of voter suppression have landed Georgia squarely in the national spotlight. Secretary of State Kemp's office is facing multiple lawsuits for rejecting registration applications, absentee mail-in ballots, and purging voter rolls, measures Kemp defends as preventing fraud. Last week, a judge ruled that state election officials cannot reject mail-in ballots if signatures do not match those on file. Voter suppression has a long, violent history in Georgia. So what is it today? And how do we as citizens spot it? And how should the state ensure the integrity of elections? Jessica Hoosman is national politics reporter for ProPublica. She oversees a collaborative journalism project called Electionland, a coalition of newsrooms across the U.S. covering problems voters are facing in 2018. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Aline Owens is also with us. She's a lecturer in the Political Science and Public Affairs Department at Savannah State University. Aline, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. I'm going to start with you, Jessica. Just a little primer on Electionland, which GPB is a part of, along with about 100 organizations around the country. What is Electionland doing?
So what we are doing is we're taking in real-time notifications of things that are going wrong at the polls, most notably from the call-in line 866 Our Vote, which is managed by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. We also have thousands of people across the country who text us or report in their experience at the polls. And we take those reports and we send them back out to local newsrooms so that they know exactly where problems are occurring at the polls and can go straight there. So it's a really powerful tool that allows journalists a great tool bag to cover the election from an administration perspective and not just a campaign perspective.
So, Aline, not everyone thinks voter suppression is happening in Georgia, but Electionland and other projects are monitoring it. This term keeps popping up in the news. What does it actually mean?
Voter suppression are the strategies and methods used, both legal and illegal, to influence the outcome of an election. And it suppresses the vote for particular groups.
Based on what's happening in Georgia, signature match, exact match, voter roll purges, what's happening in Georgia? Does that meet the definition of voter suppression?
Certainly, certainly. It is so interesting. In fact, The Atlantic had an article this month that said that voter suppression is the new old normal. Certainly from Randolph County and back in the early part of the year in April, when they were talking about closing 7 of the 9 polling places. And recently we had the incident in Jefferson County where seniors were initially denied the right to vote. Certainly you've talked about the purge that has been so much in the news, use it or lose it, where about 850,000 registered voters were removed from the polls between 2013 and 2017. And certainly making national news is the exact match law that Georgia has.
And Jessica, you from outside of Georgia in election land, what does your organization do when they hear these kind of charges and how do they investigate them?
Right. So we get these charges in. Usually we hear from voters themselves who feel like they have been removed from the rolls unfairly or in many cases haven't received an absentee ballot in the way that they should have or were given incorrect information about how to cure their ballot at the poll or how to cure the mistake on the rolls at the polls. And what we'll do is we will vet that story to make sure that it's true and the voter was well informed. And if they were, then we'll send them to local media so that the local media can use their local expertise and get that message out so that the problems at the polls correct themselves or administrators are made aware of these issues.
Well, we have been asking listeners if they have experienced anything like voter suppression. Got a call from Camilla Dawson of Macon, who reported trouble when she went to cast her ballot early. The poll worker told her that she was registered to vote absentee, but Camilla never received a ballot. Eventually, she was able to vote in person. Here she is.
I'm concerned, and I even asked her, I said, how do I know, how can I be assured that the way I vote today is going to be recorded, actually. I have trust issues with this voting in Georgia.
Well, that is just one person's account. Our reporter did check the Secretary of State's website and found that Camilla's vote was recorded in Bibb County on the 23rd of October. But this speaks to the anxiety about the process. Jessica, do you consider that anxiety in itself to be voter suppression?
You know, I do, and I think that this is one of the things that we're trying to help local media across the country strike a balance in. I think that it is really important to report on these issues. I think that it is important to do so in a way that does not further inflame the situation. I think that the vast majority of people will be able to go to the polls across the country and vote without a problem. And to the extent that we overhype or report problems without reporting also that there is a solution to those problems, we can really stoke flames and convince people that their time is better spent staying at home or staying at work. And so that's really something that we're concerned about. And so as we've helped our partners in Georgia and also other states that are facing similar issues like Texas and Florida and Arizona, we're really trying to encourage our partners to report at the top of their story solutions for voters so that they know that they exist along with the problems.
That's Jessica Huseman from ProPublica. She's a national politics reporter. Also with us, Savannah State lecturer Aline Owens. We're talking about voter suppression past and present. Well, of course, election officials and many citizens say this isn't about suppression. It's about taking measures to prevent voter fraud, which is a good thing. Jessica, I'm wondering, based on your work, which is in data, what kind of evidence is there of fraud?
There isn't. There isn't any evidence of fraud. I mean, we see across history isolated attempts at fraud. Very rarely there are campaigns that affect a few dozen ballots here or there. These are usually mail-in ballots or absentee ballot frauds that we see the most numbers for fraudulent ballots cast. But the type of fraud that could be fixed by the steps that people like Brian Kemp or the Texas legislature, for example, take are meant to address a type of fraud that we don't actually ever see, which is voter impersonation or people showing up to the polls and casting ballots in other people's names or fraudulently registering and then voting as that fraudulent person. I think that when we talk about voter fraud, we often talk about it in a way that's not helpful and is not based on the scope of history.
You mentioned the Texas laws. This within hours of the decision in 2013, a Supreme Court case, Shelby County versus Holder. This was for voter protections. Those were enacted, and in several other states. Ellen, give us a little bit of a sense of that history of what happened after this case. And please, first, a summary of the case.
Well, Shelby County versus Holder basically went to the Supreme Court and tested the Voting Rights Act. In the Voting Rights Act, Section 4 mandated or provided for a formula that states were determined whether or not they were violators historically of voting laws. And the Section 5, if you were a violator of voting rights, then Section 5 says that you have to have preclearance. And the Supreme Court basically said, well, you know, there's no evidence in Shelby County, so no, the preclearance requirement for Section 5 is not going to apply going forth. And with that, in 2013, that's when the case was decided. With that, in 2013, we saw the resurgence of a lot of voter suppression.
So then there was previously under federal law, under the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the federal government was in charge of or overseeing elections. In 2013, it reverted back to the states, correct?
Well, now, the states never gave up their authority to govern and supervise elections. That is a state function. But because of the massive discrimination and practices of voter suppression, certain states, particularly southern states, but not exclusively the southern states, they had to get preclearance whenever a voting law or practice was changed. And that decision with Shelby County in Alabama versus Holder, the former AG, Eric Holder, said that they no longer met the criteria in Section 4, and therefore the preclearance criteria in Section 5 was not necessary.
So, Jessica, looking at that and the effect of Shelby versus Holder on elections, give us a little sense of the history of how voter suppression has worked in the past, because we're hearing these accusations of it today. Are the tactics different?
I think that now people can be a little bit more open about the fact that of what they're doing. I think that the Supreme Court has been has had interesting rulings in the past couple of years on this topic. They seem not to be very concerned with this topic. They seem to have a lot of deference for states, which means that as long as states and governing officials are not overt in saying that their intent in behind passing these laws is racist or some other negative thing, that they can kind of do what they want, and we should assume that legislators are acting above board. And so what that allows legislators to do is pass laws that are facially neutral, even though they have a disproportionate impact on a specific group of people. I think, for example, there's a lot of evidence that the Texas voter ID law restricts its harms to a very small subgroup of the population, but that is not being considered as a motivation. We can only look sort of straight at exactly what they say that the purpose is. So I think that legislators across the country are able to pass laws that impact a very specific group of people without much threat of oversight.
So no longer poll taxes, no longer literacy tests. But what do you think in the reporting that you're hearing from states prevents a person from voting today?
I think that a lot of what prevents people from voting is sort of normal things like poll worker confusion. So I think that there are certainly thousands of people across the country who are prevented from voting because of restrictive laws like voter ID or voter roll purges. But I think the vast majority of people who end up being disenfranchised on election day are disenfranchised because of poorly trained poll workers, because of bad machines that don't work or don't cast your ballot in the way that you think that they are. And I think that all goes back to a lack of dedication to fixing election infrastructure in this country. And I think it also goes back to the fact that we're in a really interesting time right now. So we saw this in Texas ahead of the 2016 election. I think we're going to see it in Missouri ahead of this election, that voting laws are changing so frequently now that poll workers can't keep up with the laws. So the Missouri voter ID law changed as recently as a few days ago. And so now thousands of poll workers in that state are going to have to be retrained, and some of them will be retrained poorly.
Jessica Huseman, she's ProPublica national politics reporter overseeing the ElectionLand project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And also with us, Aline Owens, lecturer in the Political Science and Public Affairs Department at Savannah State. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We're going to uncover Georgia's long history of racial violence, honoring victims of lynching in the state. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia has the reprehensible distinction as the state with the second highest number of documented lynchings. A 2015 report by the Equal Justice Initiative found nearly 600 cases in the state. A memorial opened earlier this year in Montgomery, Alabama, to honor lynching victims. For some people, it is the first exposure to this ugly history. Others are still healing from the toll racial violence took on their families. This Friday, the Episcopal Diocese of Atlanta and the Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing will remember Georgia's 600-plus lynching victims. Catherine Meeks joins me to talk about the event. She's executive director at Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing, and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Historian Anthony Pitch is joining us from D.C. He wrote the book, The Last Lynching, How a Gruesome Murder Rocked a Small Georgia Town. Hello, Anthony.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Catherine, I'm going to start with you because your organization decided to memorialize these victims. Why?
Well, our job is to talk about racial healing, and I'm totally convinced that the only way we can actually have real healing is if we pay attention to all pieces of the history. And we've done such a good job of trying to deny that lynching happened and kind of wanting to skip over it. We talk about slavery and then we go to Jim Crow or we go somewhere else and we think we can skip lynching and we can't because that's just a piece of history that has to be appropriated some kind of way. And so that's what we're trying to do.
So how will you do it? How will you memorialize these victims?
Well, we have a memorial service and we remember them and then we call their names and then we are erecting a marker with all of their names on it. And this time the marker will be placed on our property so that we will have them every day. We will pass by that marker and people coming into our building will pass by it and we will be able to continue to remember them, even though we will have just had that program on Friday.
Among those marked are going to be those killed in 1946. This was an African-American couple, two African-American couples at Moores Ford Bridge in Walton County. This is something, Anthony, you wrote a book about. What happened?
Well, on the 25th of July, 1946, a white farmer was taking back a man he'd just bonded out of jail. The man was allegedly stabbed a white man. He was taking him back to his farm where he would work for free to pay off the bond. And in the car were his friends and relatives, George Dorsey, a World War II veteran, his wife, Roger Malcolm was the man who'd been bailed out. He was with his wife, Dorothy, and May Dorsey, who was George's wife, four of them. And they were stopped on a bridge at Moores Ford, very close to the town of Monroe. And they were led out. They were roped. The men were roped together. And they were taken near the banks of the river, and they were shot. And four people died like wildlife. Mm. Nobody should be terminated by this evil wildlife, like wildlife, being shot.
Well, this is just one of so many harrowing stories. Some of the charges, yeah, as spurious as walking behind a white woman, looking at a white woman, even worse. And you are working to seek grand jury transcripts from this case. Why do you want them, Anthony?
Well, we succeeded, my lawyer and I, in the federal district court in Macon, Georgia. The judge agreed that I could, grand jury files could be disclosed, unsealed. And that would give me an insight into 16 days of testimony where the jury was rigged. Some of the jurors were related to the people giving evidence. The FBI said they were lying in a report to J. Edgar Hoover, the director. And I want to get to the bottom of this. I don't intend to solve it. I don't think I can solve it. But I want to show how evil it was, the rogue jury, the rigged juries, the vicious content of the rhetoric at the time. Eugene Talmadge was running for re-election as governor, and he said things that would be totally, totally unacceptable today, but they were acceptable at that time. He spoke openly, using the N-word, denouncing people, degrading them because of their color, and he was elected. And this had an effect, in my opinion, on the people who carried out this lynching. They were followers of his, and they didn't care about the FBI prosecuting them. They said, this is a local issue, it had nothing to do with you, go back home. So they didn't get much evidence from them in the 2,700-plus interviews. The African-Americans who were interviewed were terrified that they would end up exactly like the four victims who were shot to death. And so the FBI have been reviled here because it was said that they didn't do their job properly. They bust a gut. They really worked their butts off. I had access to 10,000 approximate documents from the FBI and the National Archives when I wrote this book, The Last Mass Lynching in America. And they really worked, but they could not find jurisdiction. They could not connect a state official with what had happened in the lynching. If they had have done that, they would have had jurisdiction. And that's why the federal government was forced to withdraw from the case. The
Georgia Bureau, this also made a big impact in the federal government, a huge outcry about this, catalyzed large protests in Washington, D.C., New York City. President Truman created the President's Committee on Civil Rights after that. This, again, just four cases out of hundreds. Catherine, how are these victims of those killed in 1946 are going to be memorialized on Friday?
Well, these folks will be in the list of folks. We have a large piece of granite that will have four bronze plates on each one on each side, and all of the names of all of the victims will be on those plates, as well as a notation for those who are unknown, because we know that the fact that we've named 600 does not represent all of the people who were actually killed.
Catherine Meeks from Epsilon Jones Center for Racial Healing, also with us, the author and historian Anthony Pitch. Catherine, when that museum opened in Montgomery, Alabama, some critics said it's time to let these terrible crimes that belong in the past go. What's your response to that?
Well, I think when people say things like that, they don't quite understand the fact that history doesn't go away just because you want it to go away, and that you have to acknowledge what happened as you try to build a new narrative of a narrative of liberation. You have to pay attention to all of the pieces of history. And there's a definite intersection between slavery, lynching, the death penalty, mass incarceration, and 21st century police killings. And so to try to jump over lynching just means that you leave out one of those links of intersection, and it makes any work that you do not have a sustainable foundation. So I think that we have to remember, and we have to make atonements, and we have to say that this isn't ever going to be the way we live again. But we can't say that unless we really pay attention and own how we did live.
Well, for you, Anthony, you said you won't win this case. Obviously, the case has already happened, and justice is nearly impossible for families, given that in many cases, the murderers themselves are long dead. So what is this? What does your excavation of these kind of cases do?
It's important to write about history, warts and all. This is part of American history, a vile chapter, but it has to be recorded as it happened. And to neglect it is to defy the message of history, which is to remember, because those who do not remember are condemned to repeat it, as it's often been said.
Anthony, why did this particular case get so much attention compared to other cases that have been happening for, 50, 60 years?
Because there were four victims, and I went for it because one of the victims had survived World War II in service in North Africa and Australia, only to be gunned down by a rogue vigilante justice. It horrified me, and I have to get to the bottom of this and find out why these people have to be remembered. There is a marker, incidentally, near there where it happened. It was put up by the Morsford Memorial Committee, and it does have a very big error. It says that Dorothy Malcolm, the wife of the one of those who was killed, she was also killed, was 7 months pregnant, and a fetus was torn out of her belly. Mm. This is denied. This was not mentioned by the black undertaker who carried out the autopsies in the presence of an FBI investigator. Nobody mentioned it. The NAACP did not mention it. They were on top of this from the very beginning. A delegation from the Association of Colored Women, they met with the Assistant Attorney General. They never mentioned it. It never happened. And it's a really wicked intrusion on the truth.
Is part of your goal to correct the record?
Yes. Yeah. That one I have corrected in my book, but unfortunately it's gained currency in the internet. It is not true. And the man who's propagating this in the annual reenactment, I asked him, where did you get it from? He said, the undertaker told me. Well, if the undertaker had seen anything like this, you bet your bottom dollar he would have referred to it. You cannot cover up an atrocity like that.
Well, there are so many cases where that kind of thing did happen. I think it's probably easy for people to believe. And of course, and this is during the Great Migration of the early 20th century, a wave of African-American Southerners moved north, went to escape segregation and Jim Crow laws. Catherine, how well known were these kinds of stories and these kind of horrific things that Anthony is talking about happening? And how well communicated were they within the black community?
They were very well known and very well communicated, and they served their purpose of terrorizing people, because that's really what lynching was about, to terrorize people and to have black people not think they had any chance to live a life of being a true human being. And that's part of the reason why people were migrating, because they were being terrorized and they were trying to go someplace where they thought there would be some chance of life not being that detrimental to them. So they were very well known. And, you know, and it continues to be true that white people, white supremacists who think that the best way to control is to terrorize people. So we still have terrorizing going on.
Well, and there were, of course, postcards sold with photographs of these lynchings, souvenirs, pieces of people actually murdered. Not entirely unlikely that a relative of a person living in Georgia today could have been there. So in this memorializing, Catherine, you said it's about racial healing. What role does that kind of reckoning play?
Well, I think the first step to healing is to name what has wounded you. And I think that white people don't understand that lynching wounded them as much as it wounded the black people. You cannot have these acts of terror with people coming out with their picnic lunches and celebrating as if it's a carnival and not have the community be wounded. So one of the things that we're doing is offering an opportunity for everybody who participates to say, this was a horrible thing. We stand against it. We call these people's names. We say we're sorry, and we want to build a better world. So there's a chance for all of us to engage in some healing by being together and acknowledging what happened and why it happened, and then reasserting our commitment to making the world a place where that kind of thing does not happen.
Last summer, three African-American senators introduced a bill to make lynching a crime. Now, this was not the first time Congress has tried to distinguish the crime from other murder laws. I was a little shocked to know that that hadn't happened. How is it that they haven't passed?
Well, you know, it is hard to believe that in 2018 that conversation is being had. I mean, why would we? Lynching is an extrajudicial killing, but we have police officers doing that to people now. If you shoot somebody down in the street without a trial, that's an extrajudicial killing, and so it just speaks to our place in the country where we have just not come to terms with that there's some behaviors that are totally unacceptable and we need to do something about it. And the fact that we are holding on to lynching as still a possibility that we have to talk about making it illegal. I mean, honestly, it just is mind-boggling to think that in 2018 that conversation is having to be had.
So how do you think victims' families move forward or find closure on such a horrible thing?
Well, it's like any kind of trauma. You know, sooner or later, you have to acknowledge it. You have to be enraged. You have to grieve. And then you have to make up your mind if you're going to die, too, or if you're going to put one foot in front of the other and move forward. And I think by coming together, doing these kinds of activities, like the November 2nd event that we're doing, helps people to know that there are other people standing in solidarity with them and that they can move forward. Because you do have to move on, or else you just have allowed the lynchers and those who would do horrible things, you've allowed them to win.
Catherine Meeks from Absalon Jones Center for Racial Healing and author and historian Anthony Pitch. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, the memorial for Georgia's lynching victims will take place on Friday, November 2nd. Details at our website, gpbnews.org. And we would love to hear from you. What does racial reconciliation look like to you after hearing about stories like these? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can join the conversation on our Facebook group at GPB's On Second Thought. Just ahead, we're getting the inside scoop on the 50-Foot Film Festival. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just a heads up on tomorrow, we're going to have a conversation with Rebecca Traister. She wrote the book All the Single Ladies, which was a New York Times bestseller. Her new book is Good and Mad. It's about the history of female rage and what that has meant in political movements. That's on tomorrow's On Second Thought. But first, it's big, it's scary, and it invades tomorrow night. It's the return of the 50-Foot Film Festival. The event showcases short sci-fi, horror, and fantasy and suspense movies by Atlanta filmmakers.
There are tales of many creatures. Some have claws, some evil features. But there's none as mean as Wisp. He's the one we all despise, and you'd be lucky to survive if he ever wants your wish.
That's from filmmaker Vashmir Valentine's film Wish and the Wisp, one of those showing at the festival. And Vashmir's with us. Hello.
Hey, how are you today?
Very well. And festival director Debbie Hess is also here with us. She's giving us a little bit of a preview. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, Virginia.
Debbie, the festival sold out last year. Quite an accomplishment. So why do you think it's been such a success?
Well, I think it's just because of the support that the Atlanta community really wanted to pour out to their local indie filmmakers. And there are just not a lot of venues around town that basically wants to show indie filmmakers films and really give them that creative support. So I think it was just the community come together to just really encourage and support and help these filmmakers get their movie seen.
Well, then this year we've got a big crop. Horror and sci-fi, especially generally reflections of social issues of time and place. Are you seeing any particular themes in this year's crop of films?
Well, this year's crop of films is a cross between sci-fi and horror, fantasy and suspense. And we themed it so that it would be a Halloween treat this year. They're all really quite different, but I can't really particularly say there's a main theme going on in those this year, except that I will say that we're very excited because we have three female filmmakers in this lineup this year. And that is real exciting to see what they've been able to do in primarily a male-dominant industry.
Well, let's speak to one of the dominant males. Vashmir, tell us about your film. It's called Wish and the Wisp.
Yes, so The Wish and the Wisp is my take on A Cat in a Hat with a little Grinch mixed in. Real film that pays homage to a lot of the old stories from the past.
Mm, and it's disarmingly sweet in some way. There's an adorable tweenish girl. She's wearing pigtails in her fairy-lit bedroom. And her wishes are intercepted by this kind of humanoid-y looking monster.
Yes.
They're kind of ancient archetypes. How are those still so effective in making horror? Why do they work?
I think they work so well because from the past, some of the best wisdom that we've received were from storytelling. So when we have, like you said, these types, these gods and these demons, if you would, they teach us, you know, to be careful for what you wish for and to be more aware of what you're doing, because you never know what could be going on behind closed doors.
Well, certainly the horror and fantasy film genre is huge, but there are often these big Hollywood productions. Would you want to make one like that? You know, CGI and effects and all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. That actually is only one of 12 characters that I have so far, The Wish and the Wisp. So there's 11 more hitting behind doors and closed places that I would love to bring out.
Right. And there are 50-foot film festivals ahead of you. But where are other places where you can get these films shown?
Well, The Wish and the Wisp actually has been shown in over 37 festivals so far.
Well, bravo.
Thank you so much. It's a hard task to accomplish. We did Comapalooza, which was in Houston, Texas. We did DragonCon, which was actually out here in Atlanta, Georgia. And we've done a couple of festivals in Spain, England, as well as in Nigeria.
Well, it's so great to see that there is a big market for those. And there is, in The Wish and the Wisp, one of the kind of, I guess, vehicles is a little stuffed toy, which is also in the film Mr. Smiles, another film featured there, which could scare the daylights out of kids.
Absolutely.
Well, Debbie, these key into our fears. I'm thinking of Living Nightmare, that's another film that's being shown. It's based on three people's actual nightmares. One is just terrifying. I will not give it away, but say there is that moment in the nightmare that you cannot scream. You are unable to scream.
Exactly.
What is it that makes these little smaller scale films so exciting to you?
Well, for one thing, it leaves the filmmakers to be as creative as they want to be. They're not under this umbrella of having to produce something that's going to be commercially viable. So they can really let their imaginations run wild. They're only worried about the creative message that they're putting out. So they really have total control over what they're able to do. And on the Living Nightmare film that you just referred to, it was interesting because you watched the film. There's no dialogue in it.
Mm-hmm.
So this particular filmmaker, John Gabriel, really wanted people to feel like they were the ones having the nightmare, not you were watching someone else's nightmare. And I thought he did a very good job with the visuals on portraying that, where it was so creepy because you felt like that is what my nightmare would look like, not somebody else's. But that's just an example of what being an independent filmmaker allows you to do without worrying about a studio.
Well, there will be things that people see that are familiar to locals. No Time for Love. One of the characters lives out by the Big Chicken.
Absolutely.
And then there's a film called Residence 906, and it shows a house with those yellow street number signs characteristic of Grant Park. Here's a little clip from that.
They found bones in the basement, both animal and human. There was a mummified body buried behind a wall. And one of the closets had scratch marks that were still bloody. Whatever happens tonight, you leave this place and never return.
You've done this film festival before. How do people respond when they see those familiar landmarks?
They always say, I know where that's at. Yeah, I've been there. I know where that's at. Interesting with this particular one, Residence 906, was filmed primarily with all female cast and crew.
Hmm.
Only four brave guys, so they put it, worked on it. It was produced by Aisha Price and directed by Heather Hutton. They're really proud of that. It's a premiere screening for it, and I'm really excited for people to see it.
So when you were, what's the process for you? Do you jury these films? Do you ask for filmmakers, like female filmmakers in particular, to submit their films?
Well, we didn't ask in particular for females, but we do curate it. We do want a selection of films that have a high quality of filmmaking techniques that's demonstrated, some unusual twist on things. It was an advantage to have two of the films that were primarily produced and directed by females this year. But we do put out a call locally to the indie filmmakers if they have something, particularly premieres, that they would like to show at that particular time.
I'm thinking of the national phenomenon, Stranger Things, The Walking Dead, been filmed primarily in Georgia, in Atlanta. Vashmir, do you think there's something in this city and state that make them so suited to horror and sci-fi?
Absolutely. I think we're so used to seeing Los Angeles and Philadelphia and New York and so many different TV programming and movies, like your Avengers and NYPD Blues, that people want to see Atlanta. They want to know what's going on in the South. It's an area that we're not used to seeing on television too much, and seeing it in some of the locations are exciting.
So it's not just the income tax credit, the tax credit.
That's exactly what it is.
That make it especially well-suited. Who's making these movies? Are they people working in the film industry, trying to branch out and create their own stuff?
Absolutely. I know that our film was actually created by myself and a team of hungry filmmakers that wanted to change the way that filmmaking was made by creating something different than what's been out there.
Yeah, and you are a young African-American director. Are you also an actor, or is this your first, is filmmaking your first love?
Filmmaking would definitely be my first love. I dibbled and dabbled in acting, and I found out that my place was better behind the camera instead of in front of it.
So what did you want to do behind the camera? What kind of stories do you want to tell? Is it just fantasy and horror or others?
Actually, fantasy and sci-fi and horror have kind of been my loves. That's what I grew up on. I always tell people that sneaking in my house to watch a horror film was a regular adventure. So now that I'm older, of course, now I like to indulge in it a little bit more, with mother's permission still.
Vashmir Valentine is with me. He's one of the directors whose films are featured in the 50 Foot Film Festival. Also with me, Debbie Hess. She is the festival organizer. But they are not all horror, Debbie. Which films besides Vashmir's are you particularly looking forward to?
Well, we will be premiering our Horror Hotel series new episode called No Time for Love, and it is a sci-fi movie about a time machine. And it has some awesome special effects in it, which we're very proud of. And we also have a paranormal thriller, and we have a suspense film. So there's quite a cross-section that night of genres.
I want to hear a little bit more from A Wish of the Wisp. Wish and the Wisp, but rather this is Vashmir's film. Let's hear it.
A Wisp of the Wisp. They come out at night to steal your wish. But this wisp, I tricked into giving my wish. For wisp can be tricky when stealing a wish. Gather around, children, and I'm sure that you'll see how I tricked the wisp before he tricked me.
We can definitely hear the Dr. Seussian kind of language going on there. Did you write the film as well, Vashmir?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So tell me a little bit more about your inspiration. You said Cat in the Hat, but there is an interesting sort of two stories here. There's a grandmother telling the story to her two grandchildren. There is the story itself with this humanoid-y kind of monster.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character, whose grandmother we just heard, as a little girl, she looks African-American or at least mixed with that background. However, her brother or grandmother appear to be white. So tell me about that. Was that an intentional choice?
Absolutely. And that's because I feel like a lot of the families that are out now are mixed. And I felt like that there was a lot of children that may have a Caucasian mother and may have a black sister. Because either, you know, the family is mixed itself, or maybe there's a new marriage that came through. So I feel like those kids needed to have somebody that they could watch on television and say, hey, that's me. That's my family. That speaks to me.
Do you think that the films you and your peers at this festival and or your genre could do a better job at racial diversity?
Absolutely, 100%. I think that's something that Hollywood has always been struggling with. And so hopefully films like this, and the more that we see families like this, like that famous Cheerios commercial, will wake up Hollywood a little bit more to let them realize that, hey, maybe we need a little bit more of this in the industry.
Yeah, I asked Debbie about whether social themes, you know, we think of The Night of the Living Dead, the first one was kind of about consumerism, you know, zombies in the mall, and of course, like Godzilla, you know, that was about the atomic bomb.
Right.
What are you seeing in themes in horror, fantasy, sci-fi genre?
Imagination, and I think that's something that we lost a little bit of. We're getting too carried away with superheroes at this point in time that we're forgetting that stories actually tell stories. That's what they do. There's something to learn from. So I think that the new filmmakers that are coming out now grew up on that 80s era where you actually learned something. When you watched The Breakfast Club, you saw a great movie, but you learned something about yourself.
Hmm. And how about for you, Debbie, as you're picking these out, are there lessons to be found?
Well, I think there's always lessons in any film, any good filmmaking, and we do look for that when we're looking for films to put in this festival. It's always nice when you come across something like Vash Mir's film, which really did strike me. As soon as I saw it, I'm like, that one's going in, you know. So some say, yeah, I got to go in immediately, and others you give a second thought to, but it's always fun to put those themes together.
So, of course, this is happening a couple nights before Halloween. Do people get dressed up for the festival?
You know, a lot of people are. We tech screened our things there at the plaza, and everybody decided, I think we're going to put costumes on, so we're encouraging that, just a party atmosphere.
What do you think the larger industry, you know, a lot of people work in the industry who make these films, is that intimidating, you know, these big kind of productions? Is it a little, the barrier for entry hard for smaller horror filmmakers?
Oh, most definitely it is, because they have studio backing, they have a lot of money, they're able to put a lot of effects and things into their productions that indie people are simply not able to do. And they get so much more media attention than the smaller folks do, so it's very hard to break in. And that's why a festival like this is so important, because it gives us a platform in order to be able to showcase the quality work that we're able to do locally.
Vash Mir mentioned that his film has been screened 37 times in other places. Is that what you're hoping to do with the 50-Foot Film Festival? Connect to other film festivals going on around the country. Is there any kind of network?
Well, there's not a network that I'm aware of, but I think it would be an excellent idea for each major city that has a lot of local filmmakers to put on events similar to this in order to promote and encourage their local filmmakers. Really had not thought about that, but that is an excellent idea.
You can have that.
Thank you.
I was going to say, that's a finder's fee right there. So
you really think like you're in the business, don't you, Vashmir? What is the response been? What is it like for you to watch people watch this film and kind of get it?
It's exciting. You know, I always have cross thoughts about it, because in one minute I'm watching it and I'm, you know, seeing everything that's absolutely wrong with it. But on the other hand, I'm watching people enjoy it and getting what I wanted them to get by. So it's a gift and a curse.
Yeah, so I suppose there are things you think, oh, I would redo that one.
Oh, yeah, so much, yeah.
It must be hard as a filmmaker to, you know, I know just listening to interviews, sometimes I go back and listen and think, oh, why didn't I ask that? That was so obvious.
Yeah, and I had to do that 37 times already. So it's like...
You're getting good at it.
Yeah, I'm learning too.
May we all get good at letting go of our mistakes. Debbie, what goes into managing an event of this size?
Well, this is the first one that I've done. Well, we did the first one last year. And even though it's a smaller festival, oh my gosh, it is a ton of work. You have to correspond with people a lot. The biggest problem was trying to decide which films to put in, because you have a limited amount of time. You have to program them in around, you know, the time that you're allotted. And there were a lot of films I would have liked to have gotten in when we just simply did not have the room. But I'm glad that we had the response we did, with people wanting to be in it. But yeah, and then contacting all the media and keeping up with all the social, it's a lot of work. I have a lot of respect for people that do this on a big level now.
Well, thanks for making it happen. Debbie Haz, Vash Mir Valentine, thank you so much. And we're going to leave you with some suspenseful sound from Scott Hansen's short film, Bad Candy. It's one of the short films, many of them making their premiere at the 50-Foot Film Festival. That's tomorrow night in Atlanta. Debbie's director, Vash Mir, one of the filmmakers. And that is it for our show for today. We'd love to know what you're watching for scary movies this Halloween week. Let us know. Join the conversation. We're on Facebook and Twitter at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought.